the sixth case, the United States v. Shabazz. Mr. Leventhal.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Robert Leventhal on behalf of the appellant Samuel Shabazz. This case involves the denial of a suppression motion, and I believe we have three separate grounds for challenging that denial. Each of the grounds is sufficient on its own for reversing the denial and ordering that the motion to suppress should be sustained in its entirety. The first of these grounds basically relies on a finding that the district court made at page 13, which is also the bottom of page 5 of her decision. And there she states, and I quote, "Second, the magistrate judge credited Shabazz's account that he asked Watson, open quote, am I going to be able to get an attorney, close quote, prior to entering the interview room. However, when Watson responded by directing Shabazz to the interview room, the magistrate judge found that Shabazz was not denied a right to counsel at that time, but that the question was deferred until he entered the interview room." And here, I think, is the key point at which the court made a reversible error. The question, am I going to be able to get an attorney, is clearly an invocation of Mr. Shabazz's right to counsel, and the court never held that it wasn't. Instead, she said that the right to counsel was not denied at that time, but was simply deferred. However, there was no later time at which the right was granted.
And but I guess the problem is there's so many cases, I'll use the word picky, that have been very picky about the clarity of the request and asking whether you're going to be able to get an attorney isn't quite the same thing as saying, I want an attorney now. And I guess we have to observe that distinction.
I mean, the court never said in her decision that the statement, am I going to get an attorney, was not an invocation of a right to counsel. And the cases that we cited include a Seventh Circuit case in which the statement, can I get an attorney, was deemed to be a right to counsel, a request for counsel. And the cases that the opposing, that the government has cited, never involve a statement this clear and say that it's not a right to counsel. There were questions such as, should I request counsel, or maybe I should ask for counsel, or do you think I should get counsel? And those were clearly equivocal statements. But here the case, am I going to be able to get an attorney, I believe is in accordance with the prior Seventh Circuit and other cases that is sufficient to constitute a request for counsel.
But, you know, I guess these things are always phrased differently. So in Davis, the Supreme Court says, maybe I should talk to a lawyer, is ambiguous. And we have an old 1994 case, I can't afford a lawyer, but is there any way I can get one? That said not to be a clear request. There's so many cases that say this type of phrasing isn't quite enough.
The case where they said, I can't afford an attorney, am I going to be able to get one? That case involved a situation where the person had already waived right to counsel, had already confessed, and where the police officer said, yes, you can get an attorney despite the fact you can't afford it, and the suspect continued talking. So I think that's a very different factual situation than you have here.
No, it's just, but if we're focusing on the question, is it an unambiguous request for counsel, why do these other factors matter?
Because everything has to be taken in context. Here you have a situation where someone who had not waived the right to counsel, had not indicated a willingness to talk, invokes a right to counsel prior to being questioned.
Well, says the sentence. He says, we have to decide if that's
the correct. And the other cases were cases in which it's either very equivocal, so as maybe I should ask for counsel, maybe I should get counsel, or cases where there'd already actually been a waiver, sometimes a written waiver, in which the person has already indicated that they're willing to waive the right, and then they make an ambiguous statement. So an ambiguous statement coupled with a previous indication they're willing to waive the right and have actually given a confession obviously is different, I think, than a situation where they haven't done any of that, and prior to being questioned, they're saying, am I going to be able to get an attorney? And so I think that's a key point to focus on. The second point to focus on is that Mr. Shabazz testified on a number of occasions he asked for counsel, and that the government witness testified differently. However, the key government witness, Agent Watson, testified that he recalled Mr. Shabazz saying something about counsel or an attorney, but didn't recall what he said and took no steps to find out what he said and didn't even subjectively understand exactly what he meant or was referring to at the time. And here we have to bear in mind that the government bears a heavy burden of showing a knowing and voluntary waiver since Mr. Shabazz refused to sign a waiver form, and the key government witness, who was the key person involved in Mirandizing him and interrogating him, basically admits, well, I heard him say something about an attorney. I don't remember what he said. I didn't understand it at the time, but I didn't think it was a request for counsel. It's the court that gets to decide whether something's a request for counsel or not, and a government agent that's in the process of trying to allegedly preserve a suspect's rights needs to come to court with clear testimony as to what actually happened. I don't think it's enough to show up and say, well, I don't really remember what happened. I do remember I heard attorney, but I didn't understand it. I didn't follow up. But trust me, I didn't violate anyone's rights. I mean, I think that goes too far. And given that testimony from Agent Watson, I don't think that the government, even if the court were to hold that the statement, am I going to be able to get an attorney, is not an unequivocal request for counsel, even if the court held that, I still think the government can't meet its high burden of showing a knowing and voluntary waiver, giving the government officers testimony that he heard the word counsel or attorney, didn't follow up, didn't understand what it was meant, and didn't even recall what was said. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time unless there are any questions that the court has.
Thank you, Mr. Leventhal. Ms. Hudson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Nathalina Hudson, and I represent the government in this case. The decision of the district court should be affirmed for the following reasons. The district court's finding that the defendant did not make an unequivocal request for counsel was not erroneous, and the district court's finding that the defendant knowingly and voluntarily waived his Miranda rights was not clearly erroneous. The magistrate judge and the district court judge did not find that the defendant's statement was unambiguous. The magistrate judge found that the defendant made the statement, am I going to be able to get an attorney? And that was a question that was posed to Agent Watson. And that was a question that was deferred until they got into the interview room.
So Watson just says, let's get you down there or something like that.
Yes.
And what's the time frame in the record on that between where he makes this statement, according to what was found, and he's given the Miranda advice?
In the record, once the defendant entered the interview room, the defendant was told that they knew what he had done, and it was probably a matter of minutes that they Mirandized the defendant and read him his rights.
He's not put in the interview room and sitting there for an hour or something before they come in?
No. The entire interview lasted an hour, and that is in the record. The magistrate judge continued his analysis after finding that the defendant made that statement, am I going to be able to get an attorney, continued the analysis and determined whether or not the defendant's request for a phone call or whether or not the defendant asked for an attorney throughout the interview was actually credible. Had the magistrate judge found that the defendant invoked his right to counsel by making the statement, am I going to be able to get an attorney, then the analysis would have stopped there. But it did not. It continued. Given the magistrate judge's findings, the district court did not err in adopting the magistrate judge's finding. The district court adopted the magistrate judge's credibility determinations with respect to the defendant's statement as well as the government witness's statements. Additionally, Your Honors, the agent did not have an obligation to follow up on what was an ambiguous statement under Davis. The magistrate judge, found that the defendants did not at no time ask for an attorney.
So do you think that also disposes of his other argument that he claims that he did not knowingly and voluntarily waive his Miranda rights? But then he seems to circle back and say, because I'd been asking for an attorney somehow. So I just am interested to know how closely linked you think his two issues are.
Well, the magistrate judge found that the defendant did not credit the defendant's testimony that once he was in the interview room that he repeatedly asked for an attorney. So the only statement that's at issue in this case is whether or not the defendant's statement, am I going to be able to get an attorney, is ambiguous.
But then he refuses to sign the waiver form after he gets the Miranda rights, right?
Yes.
Even though he decides, he continues talking for a while.
Right. Well, under this court's decision in Crisp, the fact that the defendant failed to sign the waiver form is not fatal. The defendant in this case testified that he is familiar with the criminal justice system. He's been convicted of bank robbery before. He's familiar with Miranda warnings. And the magistrate judge considered the totality of the circumstances, the defendant's background, the defendant's familiarity with the criminal justice system, and determined that the defendant was really trying to hedge his bets. He understood the system. He talked to the agents in the hopes that perhaps his cooperation would be helpful to him. And at the same time, he refused to sign the advice of rights form so that he could keep the argument open that his signing of the form was not knowing and voluntary. Additionally, the defendant's mental state, the magistrate judge remarked that the defendant clearly understood his rights. He had a GED, there was no reason, no justifiable reason, why the defendant would trust the agents after his testimony that they repeatedly refused to allow him to have an attorney. Defendant points this court to the record in which the government witnesses had inconsistent statements regarding the time of the arrest and whether or not the defendant was handcuffed. But if you look at the magistrate judge's overall ruling, the magistrate judge adopted the government's version of the events. Those issues were very minor as to whether or not the defendant made a knowing and voluntary waiver of his rights. Based upon the magistrate judge's findings and the district court's adoption of the magistrate judge's findings, we ask that this court affirm the district court's ruling.
Thank you, Ms. Hudson. Mr. Leventhal?
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the language that was actually used, I would like to cite the court to a case that we discussed in our briefs, United States v. Lee. And in that case, the court says, and I quote, in the Lord decision, however, this court mentioned several requests for counsel that it considered unequivocal. Quote, I think I should call my lawyer, close quote. Quote, I have to get me a good lawyer, man. Can I make a phone call, close quote. Quote, can I talk to a lawyer? At this point, I think maybe you're looking at me as a suspect and I should talk to a lawyer. Are you looking at me as a suspect, close quote. So it's clear that different sorts of statements, as long as they express a desire to talk to a lawyer, constitute unequivocal requests for counsel. And here, neither the magistrate judge nor the district court ever stated that Mr. Shabazz's statement, quote, am I going to be able to get an attorney, close quote, was not an unequivocal request for counsel. I think a reasonable law enforcement officer would view that as a request for counsel. I mean, it's not supposed to be some sort of semantic, tricky rule that someone under custody has to cleverly negotiate in order to request counsel. There was nothing equivocal about it. There were no maybes. It was simply a question, am I going to be able to get an attorney? And the honest and accurate answer was yes. And all questioning should have stopped when that request was made. And I think basically opposing counsel in her argument here today admitted that if, quote, am I going to be able to get an attorney, close quote, is interpreted as an unequivocal request for counsel, that the questioning should have ceased and should not have continued until counsel was provided. Second of all, I think a thing that's very important that the courts always talk about in terms of these suppression cases is the coercive effect of being in custody and having a request for counsel denied. And
so why aren't the credibility findings of the magistrate judge against you on that? The magistrate judge doesn't find that the general atmosphere is so coercive that we should draw an inference of lack of voluntariness.
I'm not talking about the general atmosphere. I'm talking about the impact of saying, am I going to be able to get an attorney, and having that ignored. And the cases talk about that, that the reason why there's a bright-line Edwards rule is because once the suspect invokes the right to counsel, questioning has to cease and counsel has to be provided because it's inherently coercive. I mean, that's one of the things that Edwards and the other Supreme Court cases that discuss the bright-line rule.
The Supreme Court has been watering that down. They had a decision just last week in Montejo that it discusses Edwards, but it overrules Michigan against Jackson. So there's...
I think Edwards is still good law, and I think it is still a bright-line test, and I think that the test was violated in this instance because I think there was a request for counsel, and I also think it's very important to bear in mind that even if for some reason am I going to be able to get a lawyer was not a request for counsel, the burden wasn't met.
Leventhal, is part of your argument that the statement he made indicates a need for a further explanation of the Miranda exchange?
No, the Miranda exchange hadn't happened yet in this case. He wasn't saying, could you please give me my Miranda rights? What he's asking for is, am I going to be able to get a lawyer?
Doesn't the Miranda exchange discussion answer his question?
No, because then once he asks that question, they have to stop questioning him. They can't ask him to waive his Miranda rights. In Edwards, they re-Mirandized him after he asked for a lawyer. And the Supreme Court said that that wasn't good enough because he had requested a lawyer. They can't interrogate him until the lawyer is provided unless he reinitiates contact.
But he asked for a lawyer there. I think what Judge Tinder is saying in this case, he asks the question, can I get an attorney? And then he gets the Miranda rights, which include the statement, you have a right to a lawyer, and one will be furnished to you if you can't afford the lawyer.
I think here he didn't ask, could I have my Miranda rights or what are my rights? I think here he asked for an attorney. And I think if this court interprets that as a request for an attorney, then it was improper for the government officers to ask him to waive his right to an attorney and to begin interrogating him since he had already asked for an attorney. And he asked for it before he got his Miranda rights, but that doesn't give them an excuse to then ask him to waive those rights.
He was not an individual unfamiliar with Miranda exchanges, is that right? Didn't he testify that he had been through this process
before? But, Your Honor, if I was in his circumstance, my belief would be as a lawyer that if I asked for counsel and they refused to give me one and that they then continued to interrogate me, that that would not be admitted in court because that's what Edwards said and that's what the other cases say. And so, I mean, it seems to me that if we have a rule that says once you request counsel, interrogation has to stop, it doesn't matter whether he's sophisticated or not. What matters is the bright-line rule was violated.
Ms. Leventhal and Ms. Hudson, thank you. Ms. Bindi, thanks to all counsel. Ms. Leventhal, an additional thanks to you for accepting this appointment and obviously traveling some distance to represent the appellant in this
case.
Thank
you, Your Honor. It's been a pleasure.
Safe trip home.
Thank you.
Court will stand in recess.